We have a Mishnah in Tractate Soto, which is what the Rambam is based on. The Mishnah delineates that there are different types of wars. There's Milchemet Rishut, there's Milchemet Mitzvah, there's Milchemet Chovah. Okay, three types of wars. We have an obligation in the days of Joshua to conquer the land of Israel. And as you correctly pointed out, we have an obligation to defend the people of Israel. Let me ask you a question. The Jews in Canada that feel threatened, the Jews in France that feel threatened, would you say they have a Milchemet Mitzvah? The Jewish community is threatened. You've joined the Jewish Defense Force in France. Can you say you're fighting a Milchemet Mitzvah? I think you'll agree that not. I would point out to you that when the Rambam speaks about wars, the heading of the Rambam is Dinei, the laws of Melachim, kings, u'milchamotehem, and their wars. Who said that a concept of war exists without a king? Your assumption that any concept that the Rambam spoke about wars is relevant today is assuming that the heading is inaccurate. Sorry, but the Talmud in Tractate Sanhedrin says that Shlosha mitzvot nitztavu Yisrael kshenitchnesu la'aretz. There were three mitzvot the people were commanded. One of them was to appoint a king, and he would lead the war against Amalek. And as Rashi on the spot points out, there was no mitzvah to fight Amalek without a king. The major question is, why did the Jews in the story of Purim hold a war all out against Amalek if they didn't have a king? By what right? And by what right did they do that in Chutz La'aretz? So that's a separate question. So you could say that was a war of defense. But that needs work from a halachic perspective. What were they doing there? They didn't just kill the enemies who were attacking them, it would seem. It would seem like they had all-out war against Amalek, at least if you read the commentary of the Targum. But that's not our issue. So the first question we have to define is, does the concept of Milchemet Mitzvah exist without a king? Let's assume it does, because there was a halachic authority called Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, who wrote about 20-something volumes of responsa called the Tzitz Eliezer. And it seems from his commentary, and also from one of the responsa that Rav Eliashiv wrote, it would seem that they seem to hold that there can be, for the army in Israel today, a concept of Milchemet Mitzvah. Definitely seems that they went with that opinion. I would point out that there are great halachic authorities who do not agree with that. So even that first point of assumption that you can have a war today that's called Milchemet Mitzvah, a war that's considered a mitzvah, that's not a given. We definitely have a mitzvah, a commandment to defend. That doesn't mean that the war gets the term Milchemet Mitzvah. Those are two different questions. Meaning, just like we have to appoint an ambulance service and we have to have hospitals to protect people and to take care of people, you need an army. The concept of Milchemet Mitzvah is very different. There's a concept of protecting your citizens. That's a mitzvah. Then there's a concept of Milchemet Mitzvah. And as you correctly pointed out, the concept of Milchemet Mitzvah has many details that come along with it. Now, even though I think there are commentaries who would agree with what you said, that a war of defending the people of Israel and the land of Israel will get that heading of Milchemet Mitzvah, which is in its own right a point of contention, but even though there are those that would say that, that does not automatically mean that all the details of Milchemet Mitzvah now come into play. Yeah, you're assuming it's an all or nothing. If it gets that heading, then all the details come in. Well, no, that's not accurate. I don't think you'll find a single commentary that says, I don't think you'll find a single halachic authority that says that the details of Milchemet Mitzvah can be applied today, such as fighting the males to the finish. I don't think there's anyone that says that. One second. So then where does the term Milchemet Mitzvah, where is it relevant to us? It's relevant in terms of the obligation to fight. It's relevant in other realms. But there are many, many aspects of Milchemet Mitzvah that no one says would apply today. It's not an all or nothing deal.
So if you take away the concept of Milchemet Mitzvah, where is there any commandment to defend Israel?
Well, there is a commandment to save a fellow Jew. It says, Pikuach Nevesh, just like you have to have an ambulance team.
So where do I find the principles of warfare? Where would I know when it's okay to fire a rocket? When would I know not to?
Generally, it's not your decision. But
if I'm going to join Sahal, I'm going to have to know the halakha of these issues.
So the halakha generally says you have to work with what your commander tells you. A general assumption is that a soldier cannot make these calculations. I always tell a story when guys are about to enlist. I'll tell you a story, okay? Imagine that your battalion is on a reconnaissance mission. You guys are in the bushes, and they send one guy forward to place explosives next to a tank. And you're all watching as the guy with all the bushes attached to his uniform is crawling forward toward the tank. And as you're watching, you see a Hezbollah member crawling towards him with his knife out. And you have your gun, and you see him in your vision. And your commander says, don't shoot. And you see him etching closer. And you see the guy doesn't know that he's about to get killed. And your commander says, don't shoot. Now, before we continue the story, you have half a second left before he's dead. Do you shoot or don't you shoot? What's the correct answer?
You shoot.
So that's incorrect. You have no right to shoot. And you'll tell me, but a Jew's about to be killed. And I'll tell you that it could be that if you shoot, then the enemies will know where you are, and you've just killed the whole battalion. You cannot calculate what your commander's calculating. You have to trust your commander. And if your commander says don't shoot, and you shoot, then you deserve the death penalty. Because you might have just endangered the whole battalion. If you don't trust the commander, you can't be there. And if you're going to be there, you have to trust the commander. Because it could very well be that when you pull that trigger and they know where you are, you've just killed the whole battalion. You don't know, but you have to trust him that he knows. And if you don't trust him, then you can't be there. I always tell yeshiva students who go to the army this story, because everyone thinks, well, Pikuach Nefesh, he's going to die. And I say, you don't know the Pikuach Nefesh. Maybe you're killing everyone else when you shoot. You have to trust the commander that he knows what he's doing. And if you don't trust him, then you can't be there. If you're going to the army, you have to work with trust. And if you don't work with trust, the only way an army can work is if the soldiers are going to trust the commander. There's no other way. If you're going to start thinking, and this is especially the problem of yeshiva students, because what are you doing all day? You're learning to think, right? So you come to the army and you want to think, hey, it doesn't make sense. I'm going to sit here and let a Jew die? There's nothing you can do. You can't know what the commander is thinking. And if you can't know, then you have to trust him. I'm just saying, so that's why you're asking me what will be my decision. If you're going to that type of position, you have to give him your trust. And even though there will be times that seem blatantly wrong, like I said to a student of mine who was in a very difficult situation, that's where you're entitled to sue after the event. If you think the commander was wrong, sue him. So the student says, isn't it wrong? And I say, no. Because part of weeding out the problematic commanders is the right that the army gives you to sue. If you think the commander was inappropriate, sue him. The army gives you a venue to sue. And then he'll have to answer to his superiors. But what choice do you have? I'm saying, I don't see an alternative. The only alternative is reckless endangerment of the army. Yes, sir.
Well, I just wanted to interject that I think a slight change on the story might be more difficult to answer would be if you were given an original command, same scenario, the person crawls out and you're told everyone has to be very quiet. The commander now is doing something else. You're left there watching. Now you see a situation the commander was not aware of.
So these are questions we deal with on a daily basis, but in these questions, you have to ensure there's a very improper situation if you don't know what you're supposed to do. Part of what the army is supposed to do is that you're supposed to know what you're supposed to do at every minute. We had, a year ago, when there were riots, so a soldier came where he was with a group of soldiers advancing, and they were advancing with riot gear, and Arabs were rioting against them. He had the left side of the flank, And as they were approaching the wall on the left, he saw that there were a group of Arabs to the left ready to ambush his team. Now, he had a gun, and they had rocks, which can be lethal. And he came and asked me, was I supposed to shoot? Because I saw them approaching. And my answer was, what did your commander say? And he said, I don't know. And I said, that's where the problem lies. Don't ask me. You have to work with them to understand what they're telling you. And I brought him to higher level, higher ranks in the army, and they all said the same thing. You are not supposed to be in a situation where you don't know what you're supposed to do. Part of what the army has to give you is clear guidelines. And if they did not give you clear guidelines, then you have to use your own intellect and you have to protect your fellow soldiers. That's true. But you shouldn't get there. It should not be that way. Because as a soldier, you're not representing yourself. You're representing the people. And even though we don't like it that the army makes calculations of how to look on CNN and what they'll say in the U.S., and we have all kinds of things we're not happy about, that doesn't mean we have a right to overrule them. They're in the position to see the big picture. We hope they're making the right decisions. We hope. I'm not saying they are. I'm not saying I'm happy with it. You know, I've lost students to political decisions, political immobility, where the government refused to let soldiers defend themselves and they died. And the calculation was it wouldn't look good on CNN. But I can't fault the government. I not because I have blind faith in them, but because I know that they see things I don't see, and I can't know whether their decision was right or wrong. It's very easy for me over here to sit down and say, sure, they should have shelled that house and moved forward. Right now, we're coming up in a month's time. Amichai Merchavia was a top soldier, and the Hezbollah was hiding behind a house, and they asked for authority to flatten the house, and the government said no, and so the Hezbollah fired rockets over the house and were able to kill him. It was a good friend of mine. And he had the option of flattening the house. So you look at that and you say, you know, every year I dedicate learning to his memory. And you say, did that have to happen? I don't know. But I'm not in the position to see what they see. So I have to trust them. I'm not saying I do. I'm saying I have to. So...